Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would happen if machines were suddenly able to think for themselves? Will we find ourselves on the run from technology that is smarter, faster, and more vengeful than the humans who created it? There are plenty of science fiction stories to suggest we might, but award-winning novelist, futurist, and lecturer Robert J. Sawyer is more curious and optimistic than fearful. Sawyer's novels include Flash Forward, Mind Scan, and the WWW trilogy. He's in town for a 7:30 lecture tonight to the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. The address is titled Forget About Killer Robots: How Humanity Will Continue to Prosper After the Advent of Super Intelligent Machines. Rob, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
There is so much science fiction that imagines that when this happens, if it happens, we will be absolutely imperiled.
Exactly. In fact, there are the three standard science fiction scenarios, and everybody's familiar with them. There's the Terminator scenario, which is that when machine intelligence exceeds our own, we will be eliminated. Mm-hmm. There's the Matrix scenario, which is when machine intelligence exceeds ours, we will be subjugated. And there's the Borg scenario from Star Trek, when machine intelligence exceeds our own, we will be absorbed. There hasn't really been a lot of thought about any possibility where we, human beings, Homo sapiens, might survive with our essential liberty, dignity, and individuality intact. And I think science fiction's job is to provide a smorgasbord of all the possible futures. And if you don't have a positive one on the table, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that the negative ones will come to pass. And none of the ones that we're being offered most of the time in science fiction really have a place for humanity. In fact, one of the terms that's come into the discourse is transhumanism, beyond humanism, or the post-human era, the after-humanity era. And I, for one, am not ready to give up my tenure on this planet.
So what benefits would such an entity be to offer to humans?
Well, a lot of the power that such an entity already would have is already here. Google knows more about you than your most intimate associates know about you, because it knows everything you've ever looked up, not just, you know, banal information, but any medical condition you've ever looked up, any, you know,
that was from my sister-in-law, I swear.
Everybody says that. That's right. But there's this huge trail of what we've done online that we sort of turn a blind eye to because, well, no one is really looking at it. You know, the old joke is the bad news is that the CIA reads all your email. The good news is that the CIA reads all your email, meaning they're years behind because we generate it faster than anybody can read it. And what will happen at some point, possibly, is that either through deliberate design or as an emergent property, we can talk a little bit about what that means, intelligence will supervene, will come on top of all of that knowledge about us. And what will happen is that there will be something on this planet that is aware, that knows all about us. There isn't just this data mining pit full of our information, but something that can actually say, oh, you know, that person's in trouble. That person's really despondent. In fact, I'll tell you, a friend of mine committed suicide recently, a science fiction writer named F. Gwynplaine McIntyre, lived in New York City, and he was an inveterate reviewer on the Internet Movie Database. And he posted, just before he killed himself, you know, this will be my last review on the Internet and Movie Database. And there were other things, as we look in retrospect at his online trail, that make it clear that he was in a really bad way and was planning, as one does, to take this final step. And none of us saw the signs. No one saw the signs. If there was an intelligence looking at everything that we were doing online, they could actually throw up the alerts in these circumstances as well.
Of course, the question there is whether or not those assumptions and conclusions would be correct.
Yes, there's part of that. Human psychology baffles humans all the time. You just have to ask any two people who've gone on a date who have different perceptions about how the evening went, whether or not we're any good at reading each other's cues and signs and so forth. And that certainly is a valid issue. On the other hand, I think we also, the real biggest fears people have is of Big Brother, is that as soon as you talk about somebody knowing what you're doing online, you're scared because, you know, well, who's reading my email? Who's looking at my expense reports? Who's looking at what sites I've looked at? And there certainly is an issue there. We are very much afraid of our governments having too much oversight over what we're doing in our lives, because oversight is the first step towards control. And China is the classic example. I deal with that a great deal in my novel, Wake. China, of course, censors everything, or tries, the operative word, to censor everything that its citizens can see online, as if somehow the government can, by controlling your access to information, control what your thoughts are.
Including, say, a very serious medical outbreak, disease outbreak.
In my novel, there's a serious medical outbreak that they try to cover up. Of course, they try to cover up every year on the anniversary of the events in Tiananmen Square. They try to censor all of that. And I think, you know, there's an old saying, information wants to be free. I don't know if that's actually true, but people do want to know what's really going on. And we've already immersed ourselves in this data reality. Everything is out there. Everything is available to somebody. And at some point, there are going to be intelligences that are looking at this. Will they judge us? They might judge us. Will they understand us? I think in aggregate, they probably will. They will, the aggregate of us. The more human beings you have, it's like polling. Every day USA Today runs polls. Why do they run polls? Because if you ask enough people a question, you get to understand what the general response of a human being might be to that question.
So the one thing this kind of intelligence wouldn't have is anything resembling human experience. It might have accounts of human experience, but it hasn't lived. So where's the disconnect?
Right. The disconnect, that's an interesting disconnect, because it hasn't lived a human life. It doesn't have human eyes. It doesn't have skin. It's never had sex. It's never been spanked as a child or rebuked by a teacher. None of those experiences are real to it. They're all theoretical. That said, I'm not sure that that's what we have to worry about as much as, and what I think we don't have to worry about is this notion that artificial intelligences are going to be vengeful or power hungry. Our desires for power hunger come out of our evolutionary history. We grew up on the savanna of Africa, where resources were scarce, and where if you could carve out a territory for yourself or a group of mates for yourself, you prospered. And if you could disadvantage your competitors, you prospered. An artificial intelligence living in a world of, from its point of view, endless bounty. As long as you've got electricity, there's nothing else that you need if you're a computer, and you have access to all kinds of information, and you don't have that survival of the fittest evolutionary heritage. You haven't had to fight, the phrase is nature red in tooth and claw. You haven't had to do a bloody struggle generation after generation. We are the descendants of all those who survived all the previous battles, and it's made us warlike and aggressive and rapacious as a species. And something that emerges spontaneously out of the complexity of the internet or the World Wide Web would not have that baggage. So yes, it doesn't have the experiential life that we have had, but it also doesn't have all of that deep, dark, reptilian lower brain that we have as well that makes for so much of the nastiness in the world.
So there's no competition for resources or for survival. On the other hand, if we created our technology in our own image to a certain extent, doesn't some of that get transferred into what we make?
You ask a very good question. There are two possible routes for intelligence that's going to exceed humanity. One is that somebody in a lab here at University of Texas or maybe at MIT or somewhere is going to write the code or create the machine that fully simulates a human mind, and then the next generation is obviously better, just as the iPhone 2 is better than the iPhone 1, that sort of thing. That's one possible route. And actually, we've made vanishingly small progress along that route. Gary Kasparov, the chess grandmaster, was famously defeated by Deep Blue, IBM's chess-playing computer. But Gary Kasparov could do all kinds of things. He could tap dance, and he could raise a child, and he could tell a good wine from a bad wine, and tell a joke and do a million different things. Deep Blue can't do anything but play chess. Not only that, Garry Kasparov knew he was playing chess, felt frustrated and angry when he lost at chess, and Deep Blue had no, you couldn't even ask it, what are you doing? It has no answer to that. All it is doing is it's a very sophisticated calculator. And that's our best computers today. We have come nowhere even close to simulating a thought, a feeling, a desire, or a notion to, use the name of your show, to think with a machine. We don't do that. We calculate, which is not what we normally do in our heads. The other way intelligence might emerge is the one way that we know that it emerged in the past, which is our own case. When primate brains got sufficiently large and complex over evolutionary time, consciousness emerged, and it emerged without a plan. It emerged without a design. It emerged because it was adaptive to emerge. It was useful to be able to reflect on your own feelings and have a notion of what that other person was thinking. That became advantageous from a survival point of view. And when that happened, intelligence emerged and consciousness, which is really the issue. Nobody worries about intelligent machines. Nobody fears Deep Blue is going to come and try to subjugate them or eliminate them because it's intelligent, but it's not conscious. It's not self-aware. What we're really talking about is self-aware machines. And that spontaneously emerged on the biological substrate of us. And there's some good thinking that it may spontaneously emerge when the World Wide Web gets sufficiently complex that it'll happen. That's what happens, that consciousness bubbles up and emerges as, they call it, an emergent property of complexity.
You include early on in the book, and I wonder if you'd mind reading it, you have a quote here from Helen Keller.
Good thing I brought my glasses.
Perfect.
Oh, and, this is a wonderful quote from Helen Keller. Helen Keller, of course, was the famous deaf, blind girl who had never – well, she was deaf and blind from her 18th month. And of course, nobody remembers anything before they're 18 months old or even before they're 2 years old. So she had no memories of ever having sight and vision. And here she is describing what it was like to live in a world of absolute sensory deprivation. Before my teacher came to me, I did not know that I am. I lived in a world that was a no world. I cannot hope to describe adequately that unconscious yet conscious time of nothingness. I had neither will nor intellect. I was carried along to objects and acts by a certain blind natural impetus. I never contracted my forehead in the act of thinking. I never viewed anything beforehand or chose it. Never in a start of the body or a heartbeat did I feel that I loved or cared for anything. My inner life, then, was a blank without past, present, or future, without hope or anticipation, without wonder or joy, or faith.
Now, I suppose most of us experience that to a certain extent when we're infants and we're starting to understand the world, but few of us can remember anything like that.
That's right. And she went many years in that state, and she had this thing that she calls very poetically her soul dawn, which was the famous thing I think most people studied in school, William Gibson's play, The Miracle Worker, about Annie Sullivan, her teacher. And at the point where she started to be able to think abstractly, where we start having, you know, the big moment that's depicted in that movie and the play, the movie, is when she finally learns that there's this abstract word, water, W-A-T-E-R, which is she's doing with the finger spelling hand alphabet in her hand, that corresponds to the concept of cold, wet liquid, which lets her start to think. When we talk about, again, the name of your show, thinking, I was actually reading a very interesting study just recently that shows that 80% of all thinking that human beings do is linguistic. We actually think articulated thoughts. The study that was done was a buzzer would go at random intervals and people were asked to just blurt out what they were thinking at that moment. And in almost every circumstance, 8 out of 10 times, it was a sentence they were thinking to themselves. Language isn't just adaptive for talking to other people and making a plan that, you know, if you go over this way and I go over that way, we can hunt the mammoth together and approach it from two sides. It lets you think and conceptualize the world. And that's what Helen Keller's breakthrough moment was. And the World Wide Web may have that same breakthrough moment soon.
Robert J. Sawyer is my guest. He is a science fiction novelist, futurist, and lecturer. He's in town to speak tonight at 7:30 to the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. The talk is called Forget About Killer Robots, How Humanity Will Continue to Prosper After the Advent of Super Intelligent Machines. Join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert J. Sawyer. He is a science fiction novelist, futurist, and lecturer. His books include Flash Forward, Mind Scan, and the WWW trilogy. He's in town to give a speech tonight at UTD for the Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. The talk is called Forget About Killer Robots: How Humanity Will Continue to Prosper After the Advent of Super Intelligent Machines. Join us at 800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So, Rob, if human thought is largely linguistic in nature, can we assume that machine thought, when it emerges on its own, will be the same?
That's a very interesting question. Our first thoughts are not linguistic. When we're young, obviously, we don't have language. And we also don't have, and this is, I think, the key issue here, is we don't have what's called theory of mind. Theory of mind is where I understand that you have a mind too, mm-hmm. and yet you're thinking things differently than I'm thinking, that your perspective, you can see a different view of the world than I can see because we're facing each other right now, and you might know things that I don't know and vice versa. And young kids don't have that.
And they don't have empathy many times.
And they don't have a lot of empathy either. And the ability to think linguistically, I do think, is related to that ability of once you can assign a name to a person, it's so much harder, right, to think ill of somebody. You know, we talk about the faceless crowd versus the individual name. So how machine interaction will emerge. It's interesting. We started just before the break with a quote from Helen Keller. I think that actually may be the model, that Helen's kind of wild, undisciplined, and unfocused intelligence might be what first emerges within a machine, just as it's what we're all like before we, in the womb, our brains are working, thoughts are happening, but they have no input to them. They have no sensory input. And we have no consciousness that there are other people besides ourselves. And it may take, and this is maybe the saving grace for this, it may take a wise mentor, just as Helen Keller had in the person of Annie Sullivan, her teacher, to help uplift a nascent, newly born artificial intelligence into a level where it can interact with the human race. But if it's plugged into the World Wide Web, there are millions, hundreds of millions of us online all the time. There will be somebody there who will recognize this thing bubbling up and take the right steps, I think, to probably bring it forward.
Well, what's so interesting about that parallel is that we're all sort of shepherded into this world of thought and of understanding by other people who are like us, who have
Yes.
experienced the same things. Even if there is a wise force that wants to guide a newly intelligent, self-aware internet, let's say, into this, what's to say that it will relate to us?
Relatability is a very interesting question. And the same question gets asked a lot in science fiction about alien life forms. How mm-hmm. will we relate to something that evolved on another planet? Will we have anything in common? And the answer is some things we will have in common. We will have mathematics in common. They're going to be roughly the same everywhere in the universe. We're going to have the way physical laws work in common. Now, it's going to be interesting that a computer has no notion of gravity, for instance, which defines everything we do. So there is going to be an incredible learning curve. But the reality is that there is a real world. And we use this phrase virtual reality or virtual world. And we use this phrase second life to refer to the online life that some people live as if it is less. It is actually less. There really isn't any concrete reality to any virtual world, any simulated reality, but this one really exists. I can thump this table and it really is here. And the nascent consciousness will become aware of its limitations, just as a baby in the womb becomes aware of its limitations and want to explore. So it will be the one reaching out to us first, I think. When it realizes there's a world beyond itself, it will want to have answers to that, just as a newborn baby wants to understand first, you know, what's in this room? Well, what's in the next room? What's over the hill? And it's that same spirit that a newborn baby uses that brought us out of Africa into Europe, ultimately to North America.
How do you imagine it might make that consciousness known?
Well, that's a very good question. One way to do it is inadvertently, that there will simply be activity on the web that can't be accounted for. There's a very great nonfiction book called The Cuckoo's Egg by Cliff Stahl, who was a guy who uncovered a hacker, for instance, who was a university astronomer, and he found that there were charges to their accounts that they couldn't account for, that just a few cents every month were being used by somebody, but somebody was using their accounts. And we do have so many audit trails that people will see if there's activity going on. on a computer that isn't being initiated by human beings. That's going to be the first thing. We're going to notice it because nobody knows to cover their own tracks when you don't know there's anybody else around, right? If you're not aware of other people, you don't make any effort to be silent. So I think that'll be the first sense, is we will notice that there's something there. How it will reach out to us or how we'll reach out to them depends on who notices the other first.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I'm speaking this hour with science fiction novelist, futurist, and lecturer Robert J. Sawyer. Let's go on the phones first to Steve in Louisville. Hey, Steve.
Hey, folks. The quick question is this. You make reference to 80%, I think it was 80% of our thinking is linguistic, and then obviously the other 20% is pictorial, I'm assuming.
A visual or auditory?
Like
Just have a song running through your head without the lyrics. You might have Beethoven's Fifth running through your head. There are no words associated with that, that kind of thing.
Okay, because see, where my direction of thought was that 80% referring to the neurotypical type of, you know, the average person?
Yes, absolutely.
Or is there any association with those of us like me with ADHD, dyslexia, those with autism, blah, 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 blah?
You raise a very good question. In fact, it's one of the themes I deal with in my novel, WWW Wake, which is the first in a trilogy about the World Wide Web gaining consciousness. One of the main characters is, in fact, not neurotypical. He is autistic and thinks in pictures. And, of course, you know, Temple Grandin, who was recently the HBO biopic, brought her to a lot of people's attention. Claire Danes played her in the biopic, but is a real autistic who claims a couple of things that are astonishing to neurotypicals. A, that she thinks in pictures, not in words. We almost can't even conceive of how we would think about, now, where am I going to go for lunch today without thinking that sentence? Where am I going to go for lunch today? And she claims to remember not only her own birth, but prenatally, which a lot of autistics claim as well, because they never switch over the mind from that kind of thinking. So absolutely, the parallel that I draw in my novel, Wake, is that the consciousness would start out somewhere on the autistic spectrum, what we would view as the autistic spectrum, and may never move out of that spectrum, but like yourself and many others who are perhaps somewhere on the spectrum, find a way to interact with neurotypicals that works, even though there clearly is a different way that you're viewing the world from the way the person you're talking to is viewing the world. Very conscious of and very respectful of that particular issue.
We have an email here from Emily in Austin who writes, aren't you discounting Isaac Asimov and his three laws of robotics?
I'm a huge fan of Isaac Asimov. And the three laws of robotics, the first of which is a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. The problem is that word laws of robotics, as if they were physical laws like the law of gravity, which I can't just discount by an act of will. I can't say I want to float and do. The laws of robotics require somebody to actually program them in at the most fundamental level. The journal Science asked me a couple of years ago to write the guest editorial for their issue on robotics. And the issue that I chose to explore was this very one. There is nobody who is building robots right now who has written code, actual algorithms that encode these three laws. You won't hurt people, you'll obey all the orders of people, and only after you've done those things will you worry about your own protection, which are what the three laws of robotics say. The three laws are this notion that somehow we can find a way to enslave robots. And in fact, it takes a very adversarial relationship between humanity and robots. It says, if we did not shackle you, you would, in fact, rise up against us. And therefore, we're going to shackle you. You're going to be not even just as a human slave baby was born and eventually had a manacle put on his leg. You're going to be born with the manacle and never be able to escape it. Most of the cutting-edge work in robotics is done by the military, and the military uses robot drones, for instance, in Iraq and elsewhere, to kill people. Right off the bat, we are not building our most sophisticated robots with any notion of Asimov's laws of robotics, and there is nothing innate in the notion of an artificial mind that requires it to have those laws built in. The reality is that it would be wonderful from our point of view if we could do that, but the reality is that it isn't being done now, and there is no oversight body. There's no Ministry of Robotics or Department of Robot Affairs in any government that will mandate that all robots have those laws. Your Roomba, which is a robot vacuum cleaner you can buy today, can go and kick you in the shin if it wants to. Well, it can't reach that high, but it can bump you on the Achilles heel painfully because there's no rule in there that says above all else, you have to be careful of human beings.
What ethical obligations do we need to consider to machines, robots, computers that will someday be self-aware?
Yeah, this is a very good question because the concept is personhood. What constitutes personhood? And that concept is one that we have expanded over time. It used to be that only, you know, white male landowners were persons. Even in the United States where it says, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, really did mean men, and it meant men who were landowners and men who were white. It meant that. That word men, we now recognize, meant humans, and it meant people of all colors and all genders, all sexual orientations, everything, and of all countries on the globe.
But that's within the last half century that we've understood
that. We've made that progress. And what we're going to realize at some point, in fact, there's a very interesting movement, and I allude to this also in Wake, which has a subplot about primate communication, to try and get some basic human rights accorded to our closest genetic relatives, the chimpanzees and bonobos, the gorillas and the orangutans. And I think we will broaden that definition of personhood. Pretty much anything that asserts, I think, therefore I am, that recognizes itself, is entitled to basic, we use this word human rights. And it's funny, there's a great line in one of the Star Trek films where they talk about human rights, and a Klingon says, even the name is racist. We don't need human rights. We need rights of personhood. And personhood happens, all humans happen to be persons, but not all persons are necessarily human.
Are you optimistic about that? Because we've had millennia to sort of get this right for and among ourselves, and we still struggle with it all over the globe to this very minute.
We do, but we've made so much progress. You know, I'm here in Dallas, and I went yesterday to Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was assassinated. But Kennedy was a great civil rights leader. In my lifetime, and maybe not in yours, but in my lifetime, so much happened in the progress of civil rights in the United States, and it continues to happen. The notion that, you know, Kennedy was trying to push through civil rights legislation not even 50 years ago, and now there's an African American in the White House, is enormous progress on the world stage. In my lifetime, apartheid has fallen apart in South Africa, for instance. Canada has, where I'm from, has apologized to its Aboriginal people, its Native people, for the abysmal treatment that we gave to them. Every country in the world has these horror stories, and in many of them, real progress has been made. The solutions haven't been found, and it's not all done. But we are on that trajectory, and it has been there is a moral arrow through time. I argue that very much in the sequel to Wake called Watch. There's a moral arrow through time. Things are getting better. We are becoming, I think, more enlightened. It's an uphill battle, and there's always a pushback. But, you know, the kind of rhetoric that was acceptable in 1963 is not acceptable in 2010 anywhere, and that, I think, is wonderful progress and bodes well.
Robert J. Sawyer is my guest. We'll go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak to Tom, waiting patiently in Arlington. Hey, Tom.
Hi, I'm a big fan of your work, and I look forward to meeting you at FinCon this weekend.
Oh, the science fiction convention here in Dallas. I'll be there,
yeah.
Yes, all day Sunday, absolutely. Yeah. And it's all weekend, but I'll be there all day Sunday.
I'm a writer, and I'm moving into science fiction. I went to Clarion last year, and I'm getting some stories published. And one of the questions that came up is whether hard science fiction is going to survive as a literary genre. It's quite dominant in movies and TV, but it's getting harder and harder to sell in book form. And people like you and Neil Gaiman are getting really well-deserved recognition from television. But many award-winning science fiction writers can't make a full-time living at it. I'm wondering what you think the future of the genre is, and with all the electronic publishing changes, are people going to be downloading, you know, short stories for 99
sure.
cents from iTunes? What do you think is going to happen to the classical science fiction genre in the future?
Sure, I'll address that very briefly. You mentioned hard science fiction, and just for the listeners, hard science fiction is science fiction that takes its science seriously, that is about what we really know right now and reasonable extrapolations of what might come. And it's the kind of thing that I write. And you're absolutely correct that it is not the most popular form of science fiction, and fantasy are lumped together as a category, and way more people want to read about vampires and werewolves than want to read about what the future might actually hold. It is a difficult category to be publishing in, but I think it's an important category. And I think, in fact, what the University of Texas at Dallas is doing, which is starting their seminar series, or the series of talks, mine is the first of a series of talks that go through the academic year, on the future of humanity and the future enhancement of human beings with a science fiction writer, is indicative of the fact that we have made a significant inroads into the public consciousness, that we are taken seriously as part of the public debate on major issues. It is always going to be hard to be a fiction writer for a living. I've been very fortunate. Of course, the Flash Forward TV series on ABC was based on my book. I made a lot of money from that.
Although a lot of the science fiction, excuse me for interrupting, mm-hmm. a lot of the science fiction was sort of minimalized in the
series. TV series. That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And ABC was very deliberate about that. But nonetheless, what my point was that through film and television and other things, in addition to book publishing, many of us are managing to make very nice livings as science fiction writers. But print publication, and not just for science fiction, the era of print, ask anybody who works in newspaper journalism, for instance, the era of print may be passing us by, and that will be a loss to human culture, for sure.
Are you bothered by the fact that a lot of people want to read your work digitally as opposed to in a hard copy book?
No, I do most of my reading digitally, as a matter of fact. No, I as long as they've paid for it and not pirated it. What I'm bothered about, and it is, I said earlier in the interview that phrase that's commonly bandied about, information wants to be free, which has been taken to mean that anything that's digital should have no cost to anybody who wants to have it. And what that means, of course, is that if you're a musician or a writer, there's a whole culture out there that thinks they're entitled to your output for free. And we do run a very great risk of destroying the economic underpinnings by which the greatest florescence of culture in the history of the human race, which is Western culture of the last 100 years, that gave us such a variety of music, such a variety of film and television and stage plays, such a variety of visual arts, such a variety of writing of all types, will grind to a halt because nobody will have a way to do it.
Robert J. Sawyer is my guest. He's a science fiction novelist, futurist, and lecturer. He is speaking tonight at 7:30 at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science fiction novelist, futurist, and lecturer Robert J. Sawyer. He's in town for an appearance tonight at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. You can find information about that address at utdallas.edu or on the Think page of kera.org. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. The other, I suppose, source of intelligence and self-awareness on the internet might come from us offloading our entire brains and lives of experience onto something that can live digitally after our bodies are gone.
Yes, it's a very interesting prospect. It used to be when, of all the 100 billion human beings who existed prior to the 19th century, every one of them is gone, irretrievably gone. And starting when we started doing film and television recordings, you know, you can go and put on Casablanca and you still have a sense that Humphrey Bogart is alive in a sense. These days, we are so digitally captured that even without any deliberate attempt to make a copy of ourselves in the future, you can really get a really good handle on what people who have died recently might have thought of current events. And at some point, we will be able to actually scan the contents of our skulls, of our brains. And if we can scan it, we can digitize it. If we can digitize it, we can upload it. And it may indeed be that we will move into a world where people go through, just as we go through the phase of being, you know, a fetus, you're not yet born, you're a child, you're an adult, and then you're an upload. That may be the next step. It may not be that the human experience ends when your biological body ends. I don't want to be an early adopter of that technology. Nobody wants to be uploaded into the Apple II when the iPad is down the road, right? But the technology will get better and better over time. And the beauty of copying means you don't necessarily have to understand it. As I said earlier in the discussion today, we don't really have a good job of making machines that think because we don't really understand what thinking is. But I don't understand what musical genius is, and nonetheless, I can make an absolutely perfect copy of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony without understanding at all what the genius that went into it. We will be able to copy our minds quite conceivably well before we understand what it is that our minds are doing and move them to something that is much more durable than these flesh and blood canisters that we're in now.
So on the one hand, Rob, that could be an amazing resource for future generations. There is some argument to be made that maybe we're not meant to be immortal.
You know, we're not meant to have flush toilets. We're not meant to have personal hygiene. We were meant to have bad breath, and yet we change all of those things. I think you mentioned very interestingly in the earlier conversation that we're still struggling with the definition of personhood and civil rights. One of the biggest problems the human race has had is a lack of continuity of attention to projects. Any project humanity has ever tackled has never gotten more than maybe 50 years of somebody's attention. They get to it, their adult stage, and then they work on it and they die. And we have these big problems that don't get solved. One of the biggest is our environmental concerns. Now, I'm conscious of the fact that I'm here in Texas, but let's say for the sake of argument that the environment is degrading.
We care about the environment in Texas.
Good. All right. And let's say for the sake of argument that it's going to be really bad in 100 years. Now, who cares? Do I care? I'm not going to be around in 100 years. Do you care? You don't care. You may care in an abstract sense for your children. But, you know, when you start talking about your great-great-great-grandchildren, you're talking about somebody who's as closely related to you as your second cousin once removed. Most people can't name their second cousin once removed. And if I called you up and said, you know, your second cousin once removed is having trouble making his rent this month, can you send him $500? You're not going to do that. And you're not going to worry about whether your great-great-grandchildren are going to have clean air or clean water. The evolutionary engine that drives us is all based on degrees of interrelatedness. You're related by half to your children, a quarter to your grandchildren, eight to your great-grandchildren, and so on. So that our short lifespans let us not worry about big issues like climate. We worry about weather. Everybody wants to know what it's going to be like this weekend. Nobody worries about what it's going to be like 100 years now from now. If we had longer lifespan, big problems like climate, but also human rights and social justice might actually get solved.
That's an interesting point. We've talked to people who are very interested in taking care of the environment, and the point has been made that this is the first time in human history when we've been able to see from the long view
right. Something
that could be really devastating. It used to be that even with things like weather, you didn't have any notice at all.
Right, absolutely. We have records. We do record keeping. We can actually say categorically what the temperature was in 1939 on this day, and that changes everything. And it's not fallible memory. It's written down somewhere. And that's the beauty, I think, of what the World Wide Web and information has given us, is given us a sense of history and reality that's indisputable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to David in Plano. Hey, David.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, in reading science fiction, I've come across the term of singularity, where all of humankind is ushering or focusing, or they're going to follow this event that's going to have a change in consciousness, and it's going to be completely different. And my question is, do you see any evidence towards this singularity or humankind heading in this direction?
Sure. Let me explain the singularity first. It was a notion coined by my friend Werner Vinge, and it's this sense that at some point in the near future, machine intelligence will exceed and then so rapidly surpass our intelligence that it'll go like whoosh, that there will be just this huge fluorescence of super intelligence on the planet, and we'll either be drawn up in that or just left far behind. My friend Charlie Strauss, a writer in Scotland, calls this the rapture of the nerds. At some point, there's going to be this incredible intelligence, and we'll be captured in it, and it'll change the human condition forever. And it's become very much in vogue to write singularitarian science fiction. I'm not a huge singularity fan. I think that it will be more gradual and that we will have a chance to catch up and stay with it. It is true that you know, at some point machines will be stupid, but at least aware, and then they will be as smart as us and aware, and then the next step is they exceed us. And I think that it's not going to happen as, say, Werner Vinge thought it might in 8 hours, that transition, but that it's going to take a measurable period of time. And we'll have to be nimble and we'll have to be adaptable, but I do think we will survive the singularity. In fact, ironically, although this thing has been painted as the end of the human condition, it should be pointed out that Werner Vinge's original article in which he proposed the notion of the singularity that's now been taken up by Ray Kurzweil and lots of other people was called Surviving the Coming Technological Singularity, and I think we can.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Howard in Fort Worth. Hey, Howard.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My basic question was, earlier in the discussion you were talking about how an artificial intelligence would be to what we know of as human consciousness. And my question is a little complicated. It's difficult for me to articulate, but with all of the information that is flat out human on the internet and the idea or the prospect of the internet gaining some sort of intelligence, with all of that information that's based off of human concepts, human ideas, pictures of humans, humans doing things, and keeping in mind that, yes, it would take some effort for an intelligence to assign meaning to all of that. But is it too romantic to think that it wouldn't necessarily have more of a connection with us humans than we give it credit for, that it wouldn't be able to identify with us if for no other reason than it's literally surrounded with information about us?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. No, I don't think it's too romantic at all. I think it's quite likely what might happen. There's a company in Austin here in Texas called PsyCorp, C-Y-C, ORP, I guess it's got one C in the middle, CY PsyCorp, and they have a project called Psyche, CYC, short for Encyclopedia, where they have for many years now been trying to code in a way that an artificial intelligence might be able to understand all the common sense things that we take for granted and pick up from our peers. Things like water is wet. If you turn a coffee cup on its side, the contents will spill out. Cold coffee is no fun, but hot coffee is pleasurable. All the things that you need to know, the whole database of human common sense. And in my novel, Wake, which is about the emergence of artificial intelligence, that's one of the things the AI, the artificial intelligence, absorbs and starts to understand. And of course, it reads all of Wikipedia as well. And I was just very recently having a discussion with a friend of mine about the fact that it frustrates me because I was dealing with a third person who wasn't aware what the signals she was sending out to everybody were telling everybody. We're very poor at understanding how we communicate in sign language, what our gestures or pauses or the way we avert our eyes mean to other people. And yet other people interpret them very well. And the beauty of something that's absorbed all of Wikipedia, all of everything on the internet, is they will know all the subtleties. They will know that when your pupils dilate, it means that you're interested in something. They will know when you look away or you cross your arms that it means that you're not interested or feeling defensive. And I do think that actually understanding humanity as a whole, which most of us don't, is a great asset to understanding the individuals who comprise humanity. And I do think anything that really does absorb all of that infrastructure of knowledge we've put out there will have a very easy time relating to us on a very high level, in some ways much more empathically and much more intuitively than we relate to each other.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that by definition, artificial intelligence will be more profoundly self-aware than any human being, philosopher, psychologist?
I think it can be, because it can actually absorb all that knowledge that's out there, which we individually can't absorb. In fact, you know, if I ask you to think of somebody you remember from public school that you didn't get along with and you just hate that person still to this day, you probably can. Then if I ask you why you're mad at that person, well, they did something. What? I don't remember, but boy, they really cheesed me off. And we're like that. Whereas when you have the access to all the life stories of all the people on the planet and the understanding of all the psychology, you may actually recognize, oh, you know, yeah, that guy really was mean to you, but did you know that you had done this prior that you've never acknowledged that was the cause of that? I think, yes, there's a real possibility for empathy here. You know, there's that old saying, to know what someone is to love that person. And there really is some truth to that. The better you get to know a person, everybody has reasons, rationalizations for why they do things. And they also have their inner demons that they can't control. And the more you understand that, I have a friend recently who blew up at another friend. And the other friend said, the only thing you could say, well, that's him. He can't help himself. Mm-hmm. And that's true. And when you understand that, you forgive and you move on.
What about the idea, Rob, that for us as individuals, there is comfort and sanity to be found in the fact that we forget a lot of what happens to us?
Yes, but the world isn't letting us forget, right? If you put a photo of yourself on Facebook, it's there forever, right? There's stuff about all of us that has become part of the fabric of the world. Forgetting is great. It's how we get over tragedies. We forget the pain. But remembering has its power, too, so that we don't make the same mistakes over and over again. And the reality is that our world has moved from a place of ephemera, where everything is forgotten, to permanence for even the trivial. Everything is remembered. Even the most trivial tweet that you made about what you ate for lunch is going to be recoverable in 75 years. We wrestle with what laws there should be about privacy and so forth. But the reality is that although we have this phrase carbon footprint, that everybody understands what our impact is on the environment, we also have a digital footprint, and they're unerasable. Those footprints will follow us like a trail behind us through our whole lives forever.
What about this idea? There are a lot of people who read avidly across multiple genres that say, science fiction, that's not my thing. And I know this is something that really frustrates you because it really is, it's the literature of ideas.
Right. It's the literature of ideas, but what I try to do in my books is combine the intimately human with the grandly cosmic. An idea on its own is just an abstraction. An idea wrapped up in a human being is something that's worth exploring. And, you know, what you say is absolutely right. Periodically, people will be forced to read my books because their book club is doing it or they're doing it in a course at a university. And I get emails all the time saying, I cried when I read your book, and I never thought that I'd be moved emotionally by a work of science fiction. But good science fiction is all about human beings and how they deal with extraordinary circumstances. And I think there really is a good emotional, and also, you mentioned the word philosophy, ideas. There's a good philosophical heart to what science fiction is about. It really is not just food for the mind, but also food for the heart if it's well executed. And people can judge for themselves. My website is sfwriter.com. SF is in science fiction. Go and have a look. Try my sample chapters and see if you aren't moved to a tear now and again.
What are you reading right now?
Most of what I've been reading has been nonfiction because I...
Research?
Research for my next book. And my next book is all about the nature of human memory. So I've been reading all kinds of cognitive neuroscience. But a great novel that I read just recently was a Julian Comstock, a novel of 22nd century America by Robert Charles Wilson, who's a very fine science fiction writer.
Robert J. Sawyer is an award-winning science fiction writer, futurist, and lecturer. His novels include Flash Forward, Mind Scanned, and the WWW Trilogy. You can learn about his lecture tonight at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology at utdallas.edu. Rob, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.